It's a special privilege for me to introduce to you my father, Leland Ryken, who is the Clyde S. Kelby Professor of English Literature at Wheaton College in Illinois, where he has taught since 1968. He was educated at Central College in Iowa and at the University of Oregon, from which he received the doctoral degree. He is the author of more than 20 books, particularly books on the poetry of John Milton, on the Bible as literature, on the Puritans, and two books that have come out in recent months. One, the Ryken's Bible Handbook, which is a guide for people who study and teach the Bible, particularly lay people. And then also this book on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which I've just mentioned, a literary analysis and study guide to that book. When I was a young boy, when I went to visit my father in the English department at Wheaton College, I would open the door to the department and step into the hallway, and very close to the door was the wardrobe. The beautiful, heavy, dark, wooden, ornately carved wardrobe that had been had belonged, I believe, to C.S. Lewis's grandfather and had been in his home growing up in Belfast. And I would sometimes wonder what it would be like to open the wardrobe and maybe to step in. I mean, you could step into the wardrobe and have whatever adventure you would have, and nobody would ever know, right? Because time is different in Narnia than it is in this world. And I used to imagine what it would be like to step into the wardrobe. And when I was a young child, it almost seemed to me, before I had really heard any of the C.S. Lewis stories or read anything by C.S. Lewis, it almost seemed to me that C.S. Lewis was a member of our family, because people were always talking about C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis said this and C.S. Lewis said that. So perhaps it's not surprising that my father now has written a book about C.S. Lewis and his writings, having been very influenced by his approach to literature. And I hope you'll join me in welcoming this evening for the first of his two lectures, Leland Ryken.
Thank you. My co-author in the book that Philip mentioned works in the Wade Center, and she reports that when children come through and put their hand into the wardrobe, usually there's a look of disappointment on their face that there's actually a back to the wardrobe. And she also recounts the situation of a little girl in the neighborhood who would come weekly to have her weekly fix of seeing the wardrobe, and then she'd go back home. Reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe with C.S. Lewis. This was my chosen approach when I co-authored a reader's guide to Lewis's classic story. What made that idea a natural one? The answer, Lewis bequeathed a richer legacy of literary criticism and theory that can be applied to his imaginative writing than any other author I know. From Lewis's nonfictional writing, we can glean a large and detailed picture of what Lewis thinks we should do when we read literature, how we should read it, and how we should not read it. With the understood premise that I have garnered my data from C.S. Lewis himself, I propose to cover three topics in this opening session. First, how not to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Second, how to read The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. Third, how to read a children's book as an adult reader. First, then, how not to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We cannot read very long in Lewis's criticism before we sense that Lewis was preoccupied with sparing his readers from wrong ways of reading. I therefore conclude that to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in keeping with the spirit of Lewis's own ways of reading literature requires us to avoid the pitfalls that he himself delineated. Here is what Lewis thought about three common forms of misreading. And as I elaborate them, you will doubtless recognize them as ways in which Christian readers commonly deal with the Narnian Chronicles. Bad practice number one is using The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe instead of receiving it. C.S. Lewis was against using a work of literature in the sense of immediately harnessing it to advance a reader's agenda of interests or beliefs. This is not to imply that we do not make use of what we read. It is rather a comment on an author's right to be listened to before being judged, and also an assertion about the proper sequence by which we should go about assimilating a work of literature. In his book, An Experiment in Criticism, Lewis stated this principle, I quote, "We sit down before a picture in order to have something done to us, not that we may do things with it. The first demand any work of art makes upon us is surrender. Look, listen, receive, get yourself out of the way." End of quotation. The application to a reading of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is twofold. For someone who is reading the story for the umpteenth time, Lewis's directive is an encouragement to stare at the text carefully, deliberately looking for new effects, new meanings, new intricacies. For any Christian reader, moreover, Lewis's axiom of receiving rather than using is a call not to be coercive or impatient in regard to the religious meanings of the story. The religious meanings can be trusted to reveal themselves at the appropriate time, which, let me say, is a relatively late point in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Lewis's formula was, I quote, "Let the pictures tell you their own moral. Let the pictures tell you their own moral." Bad practice number two is to value The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe primarily as a collection of ideas. Lewis saved some of his sternest warnings for this very practice. He claimed that to regard a work of literature, quote, as primarily a vehicle for philosophy is an outrage to the thing the poet has made for us. Furthermore, quote, "One of the prime achievements in every good fiction has nothing to do with truth or philosophy at all." Now, lest I overshoot the mark on this point, let me anticipate a later point that I will make and say that Lewis would not wish us to think that The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is devoid of religious ideas. The caution is that we should not reduce a work to its ideas, thereby suppressing other equally important aspects of it. Misconception number three is to assume that when Lewis composed The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he started with a set of ideas and then created fictional details to embody them. While strictly speaking, this concerns the composition rather than the reading of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, in fact, our conception of the origin of a work exerts a formative influence on how we read and interpret that work. Lewis's statements about the genesis of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe are surely some of the most surprising passages in the whole realm of literary autobiography. And I'm going to quote the two passages. The first is this: "All my seven Narnian books began with," how would you complete that? "Began with seeing pictures in my head. At first, they were not a story, just pictures. The Lion all began with a picture of a fawn carrying an umbrella and parcels in a snowy wood. This picture had been in my mind since I was about 16. Then one day, when I was about 40, I said to myself, let's try to make a story about it. At first, I had very little idea how the story would go. But then suddenly Aslan came bounding into it. I think I had been having a good many dreams of lions about that time. Apart from that, I don't know where the lion came from or why he came. But once he was there, he pulled the whole story together. And soon he pulled the six other Narnian stories in after him." And in case we think Lewis had just gotten it wrong, in another passage he says this: "Some people seem to think that I began by asking myself how I could say something about Christianity to children, then fixed on the fairy tale as an instrument, then drew up a list of basic Christian truths and hammered out allegories to embody them. This is all pure moonshine. I couldn't write in that way at all. Everything began with images, a fawn carrying an umbrella, a queen on a sledge, a magnificent lion. At first, there wasn't anything Christian about them. That element pushed itself in of its own accord." The application of this to the reading of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is far-reaching in its import. If the composition of the book began with images, our reading of it must begin the same way. The order of composition suggests an order of reading and assimilation. The story, the imaginative construct, has a place of precedence in the sense of coming first. In summary, if we intend to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in any of the following three ways, C.S. Lewis would like us to forget about it. Using the book instead of receiving it, viewing it primarily as a set of ideas, and assuming that the story is simply the vehicle that Lewis created to clothe a Christian vision. How then would Lewis wish us to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Good practice number one is to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first as an escape from the real world to an imagined world. To be transported is the goal, unencumbered with anxiety about fears of escapism. I am permanently indebted to Lewis for liberating me from the burden of anxiety and guilt under which I struggled for many years following my freshman year in college, when I used Lawrence Perrine's book, Story and Structure, as an introduction to narrative. The opening chapter of that great book laid out the two options of the stories being either interpretive or escapist. For years, I lived with a burden of anxiety over the possibility that I might, at any given moment, be reading for escape rather than interpretation. And by virtue of that, to have betrayed my uptight Dutch Reformed heritage. It was a heavy burden, I want you to know. Well, here is the prison-breaking passage from Lewis's book, An Experiment in Criticism. Quote, "Now, there is a clear sense in which all reading whatever is an escape. It involves a temporary transference of the mind from our actual surroundings to things merely imagined or conceived. This happens when we read history or science, no less than when we read literature. All such escape is from the same thing, immediate concrete actuality. The important question is what we escape to. The first thing we need to do when we reread or read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is to allow ourselves to be transported. The magic of walking through the back of the wardrobe should indeed never end. Good practice number two is to enter into the particularities of the imagined world that a writer creates. World making is one of Lewis's greatest gifts as a fiction writer, and it is equally a quality that he relished in the literature about which he wrote. Lewis endorsed Tolkien's theory of the writer as a sub-creator, someone whose function, in Lewis's words, is not making a comment upon light, but making a subordinate world of his own. When we enter the imagined world of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we should relish rather than scorn the details that make up the surface level of the story and the obvious human experiences that are portrayed. We should avoid the error of Renaissance humanists, whom Lewis scolds for not being able, quote, to bring themselves to believe that the poet cared about the shepherds, lovers, warriors, voyages, and battles. They wrongly assumed that these elements must be only a disguise for something more, quote, adult. To pay attention to the surface details of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe means that we will not be troubled in the least by the unlifelike qualities of a fantasy story. According to Lewis, it is the unliterary who, quote, mistake art for an account of real life. Good practice number three is to view the far-flung fantasies of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as a window to reality and truth. One of my favorite passages in Lewis's literary criticism is his brief foray into Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willows. First, Lewis lists aspects of the story that make it, quote, a specimen of the most scandalous escapism. And yet, Lewis claims, the story is full of the simplest and most attainable things. Food, sleep, exercise, friendship, the face of nature, even in a sense religion. To clinch the point, Lewis writes that, quote, the whole story, paradoxically enough, strengthens our relish for real life. And the next sentence was a landmark in my own theory of literature. This excursion into the preposterous sends us back with renewed pleasure to the actual. This excursion into the preposterous sends us back with renewed pleasure to the actual. I would add the word an understanding, increased or renewed pleasure and understanding. I'm also reminded of Lewis's statement that a person does not despise real woods because he has read of enchanted woods. The reading makes all real woods a little enchanted. Good practice number four is to value the artistry and technique of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as a self-rewarding aesthetic experience. Enjoyment of the text was a very high priority with Lewis. He wrote, for example, that every episode, explanation, description, dialogue, ideally every sentence, must be pleasurable and interesting for its own sake. Lewis was of the opinion that a great deal, not all, of our literature was made to be read lightly for entertainment. If we do not read it in a sense for fun, we are not using it as it was meant to be used. On one occasion, Lewis used the word deliciousness to denote this dimension of literature. Quote, "We demand what I should call deliciousness, what the older critics often simply called beauty." Lewis rejected the view that the content of literature takes precedence over its form. In a preface to Paradise Lost, Lewis wrote, "It is easy to forget that the man who writes a good love sonnet needs not only to be enamored of a woman, but also to be enamored of the sonnet." Good practice number 5 is to recognize and value the religious and moral viewpoints embodied in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Despite Lewis's dislike of allowing literature to become, as he said, a religion, a philosophy, a school of ethics, anything other than a collection of works of arts, unquote, he did not question that literature has a moral and ideational dimension. "Wisdom by itself does not make a poem," Lewis wrote, "and the value of a poem is by no means in direct ratio to its wisdom, but the demand for wisdom remains. The demand for wisdom remains." Speaking as a writer of children's literature, Lewis wrote, "The only moral that is of any value is that which arises inevitably from the whole cast of the author's mind," showing that Lewis did, in fact, espouse the possibility that a story will have a genuine moral. My third and final topic in these introductory remarks is how Lewis advises us as adult readers to read a children's story. For half a century, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe has been a classic of children's literature. In many Christian circles, it has been the classic children's story, the book in which many children discovered that they loved literature, and the book that awakened their imaginations and appetite for fantasy worlds. For many children, it was also a book that awakened or enhanced their grasp of the Christian supernatural and the attractiveness of Jesus. But The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is also paradoxically a book widely read by adults who bring adult understanding and literary sophistication to it. Many of them remain readers of the book because The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe has the status of a social institution in which succeeding generations of children are initiated into the pleasures of the book by adults who do not want them to miss out on a good thing. Adult readers actually experience the story at two levels, the level of children, either their own recalled childhood and or the children to whom they read the book, and the level of mature readers with a superior grasp of the nuances of the book. The ability of the book to hold its readers into their later years is perhaps as amazing as how early it attracts the young. Who is the better reader of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the child or the adult? If we can trust the scattered statements of C.S. Lewis, the answer is not as clear-cut as we might think. There are ways in which the child's response is better and is something that adult readers should strive to retain. Lewis himself said something close to this in his commentary on Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen. The Fairy Queen, according to Lewis, quote, "demands for its full enjoyment a double response. One level is that of what Lewis called the innocent and naive taste, for which Lewis elsewhere uses the adjective simple. The other level Lewis labels sophisticated. The first axiom that Lewis would wish us to apply to reading a children's story is not to be condescending toward such a book. The view of Lewis on this subject doubtless flows from the fact that he himself did not read The Wind in the Willows in E.S. Nesbitt's Bastable Family Books until he was in his late 20s. Though he was a devotee of fairy stories from childhood. Lewis took his stand against what he labeled the modern view that accuses adult readers of fairy stories of, quote, arrested development because we have not lost a taste we had in childhood. But surely arrested development consists not in refusing to lose old things, but in failing to add new things. Lewis further theorizes that he considers the fact that he came to enjoy Tolstoy and Jane Austen and Trollope, as well as fairy stories, growth. If I had had to lose the fairy tales in order to acquire the novelist, I would not say that I had grown, but only that I had changed. I think my growth is just as apparent when I now read the fairy tales as when I read the novelist, for I now enjoy the fairy tales better than I did in childhood. Elsewhere, Lewis wrote that no book is really worth reading at the age of 10, which is not equally and often far more worth reading at the age of 50. The only imaginative works we ought to grow out of are those which it would have been better not to have read at all. What these comments suggest is that we should read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe unapologetically as adult readers. Adult readers emphatically do not need to leave behind their sophisticated literary ways of reading when they assimilate The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Secondly, though, and paradoxically, adult readers of the book need to continue to read the book as a child. The childhood responses and delights should not be suppressed. For this, too, Lewis can serve as a guide. Lewis said regarding Spenser's Faerie Queen, its primary appeal is to the most naive and innocent tastes. It demands of us a child's love of marvels and dread of bogies, a boy's thirst for adventures. If you have lost or cannot rearouse these attitudes, all the commentaries, all your scholarship will not avail. The poem is a great palace, but the door into it is so low that you must stoop to go in. To apply this to the adult reading of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we should read the book with a child's imagination as well as an adult's understanding and literary sophistication. At the end of his classic essay on Hamlet, Lewis wrote, "I am trying to recall attention from the things an intellectual adult notices to the things a child or a peasant notices. In a sense, I have kept my promise of bestowing all my childishness upon you. A child is always thinking about those details in a story which a grown-up regards as indifferent. I claim that only those adults who have retained, with whatever additions and enrichments, their first childish response to poetry, unimpaired, can be said to have grown up at all. Mere change is not growth." And I was just a little surprised this morning when rereading the story to be reminded of what Lewis says in his introductory note to Lucy Barfield. "My dear Lucy, I wrote this story for you, but when I began it, I had not realized that girls grow up quicker than books. As a result, you are already too old for fairy tales, and by the time it is printed and bound, you will be older still. But someday you will be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. You can then take it down from some upper shelf, dust it, and tell me what you think of it. I shall probably be too deaf to hear and too old to understand a word you say, but I shall still be your affectionate godfather, C.S. Lewis."
For those who have come in late this evening, had difficulty finding a parking place, perhaps you've been listening to Leland Ryken give an opening lecture called Reading Narnia with C.S. Lewis. We're now going to have a dramatic reading of chapter 14 of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, a chapter entitled The Triumph of the Witch. And following the dramatic reading, Dr. Ryken will be speaking about that chapter and how the literature of that chapter works. The dramatic reading will be done by Mr. Brian Glass, who is the director of Mere Breath Drama Ministries here at 10th Church, although that's a drama group that also plays in many other churches in other places around the city, and also the author of the recent novel Quixote. Mr. Glass will be joined by Kira Fallon, playing the part of Lucy, and by Anna Taylor, playing the part of Susan, and we're assisted in the lighting by Mr. George Petrella. Please give them a round of applause as they prepare.
What I'm going to do in this second presentation is share with you what I did in the chapter devoted to the chapter from Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe that we just saw dramatized in my Reader's Companion to the book. The chapter in Lewis's book is entitled The Triumph of the Witch. I subtitled as my interpretive slant on that chapter The Passion Story in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Philip made the excellent suggestion that for our purposes tonight and in view of what we've just heard, I could entitle the material, The Triumph of the Lion. I divided my commentary on the chapter into two sections. The first I labeled The Bible as Source and Influence in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The Bible as Source and Influence in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There can be no doubt that the Bible functions as a subtext for The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, an understructure on which C.S. Lewis constructed some, but not all, of his story. But there is a right way and a wrong way to go about applying this principle. A story needs to be allowed to set its own agenda regarding what we see in it. Any biblical element that we see in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe needs to have some warrant in the text, some signal that the author intended us to bring the Bible into interpretive play. This contrasts with forcing every chapter of the book onto a Procrustean bed in which we see how many biblical echoes we can find in every part of the story. C.S. Lewis himself asserted the following principle: a work of whatever art can be either received or used. When we receive it, we exert our senses and imagination and various other powers according to a pattern invented by the artist. When we use it, we treat it as an assistance for our own activities. The big contrast here is doing with a text what the pattern invented by the artist asks us to do, in contrast to our imposing our own activities on the text. In other words, the story must be allowed to set its own agenda of topics and concerns. Applied to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we must be ready to see Christian meanings and biblical allusions in it where they exist, but not elsewhere. If we follow the contours of the story as C.S. Lewis told it, it is obvious that the religious and biblical references cluster in the last five chapters. Until that point, the story is governed by the narrative dynamics of the fairy story and romance. Attempts to list Bible verses for every chapter of the book are word association exercises, not insights into the story as Lewis told it. While biblical allusions do not abound equally in every part of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there are ways in which the Bible can be seen as a presence all the way through. This has to do with the overall narrative structure rather than specific references or parallels, and it concerns the Bible as a model and influence for how C.S. Lewis handled his material, not as a source of allusions. Central to Lewis's enterprise in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is the theme of the two worlds. This refers to the premise that reality exists on two levels, the visible world in which we live and an unseen supernatural realm that is no less real. The invisible world interpenetrates our world and influences what happens in it. From beginning to end, the Bible exhibits exactly the same pattern of events happening on two levels, the earthly and the supernatural or otherworldly. While one cannot prove that Lewis was following the Bible as a literary model in this regard, it is a fair assumption. And in any case, the biblical model is simply a useful framework to have in our minds as we read. Secondly, the Bible possesses what literary scholars call a meta-narrative, a big story, of which the individual stories and poems are individual chapters. The big story is a story of cosmic, universal conflict between spiritual good and spiritual evil. The structure of this story is in the shape of a U, and it has four main phases: God's creation of a perfect world, the loss of that world through fall from innocence, fallen human history, and a final defeat of evil and restoration of the good. Within this story, the story of God's unfolding plan to redeem fallen creatures provides another meta-narrative. Key points include God's dealings with a covenant people, his promises to send a Savior, the coming of Christ as the atonement for human sins, and the participation of believers in this drama of forgiveness and salvation. As we read the Bible, the immediate foreground of its stories and poems keeps opening up into this larger story, of which we are nearly always aware. Now, a feature of the Reader's Guide that I composed is interspersed questions either for reflection or discussion, but I particularly had in mind the potential of study groups using the questions. So, for reflection or discussion, following the section I just shared with you, you might wish to page around in the book, that is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, for passages that use the Bible's method of placing individual details into larger contexts, including the following: earthly experience set into relation to an other supernatural world, the theme of the two worlds, or windows from the immediate action into a backdrop of the larger history of Narnia, with its story of cosmic battle between good and evil, and Aslan's redemptive life and resurrection as the decisive events in this great struggle. At that point in our book, we also have the following boxed item. C.S. Lewis followed the model of the meta-narrative when composing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The immediate events that the children experience in Narnia are repeatedly placed against the backdrop of a bigger story, the meta-narrative, involving Aslan's ongoing struggle with the White Witch, as well as references to the larger history of Narnia, which precedes this immediate story. Even though we are made aware of this long historical context, we do not as yet know much about it. Those who have already read the other Narnian stories will know that one in particular. We'll know that one in particular, the magician's nephew, fills in pieces of this early history. There's an ongoing debate among Lewis scholars as to whether the book should be read in the order of publication or according to the chronology of the meta-narrative. The second section for my guide to the chapter 14 I entitled The Passion Story, Displaced into Narnia. In addition to the large-scale presence of the Bible as a subtext, as already noted, there are chapters late in the book where biblical parallels and allusions abound. Here, the cautions I shared a few minutes ago need not deter us. In fact, the parallels in chapter 14 to the story of Christ's suffering and crucifixion, as narrated in the Gospels, are so obvious that even Lewis's attempts to force a wedge between The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, an allegory, begin to break down. We can take Lewis's word for it that he did not set out to see how many details of the Passion story he could embody in his fantasy story. But we need equally to remember that even though Lewis felt a need to assert that, quote, at first there wasn't even anything Christian, unquote, about his fantasy pictures, he went on to say, quote, that element pushed itself in of its own accord. In other words, the Christian meaning of the story is present as a result of the fact that it existed already in the very fabric of Lewis's being, along the lines of his comment, the only moral which is of any value is that which arises inevitably from the whole cast of an author's mind, rather than something that Lewis arbitrarily attempted to paste into the story. Determining the parallels between the Passion story in the Gospels and in chapter 14 of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is something that you need to work out in ways that are most meaningful to you. To prime the pump, here are some key events and moments that will loom large in the exercise. A journey of Aslan and his followers to a place of execution, with Aslan spending part of the journey giving his followers instructions for a coming battle. An affecting and somber evening meal. Two sleepless followers trailing Aslan to the place of execution. Aslan's announcement that he is sad and lonely. The execution of Aslan amid jeering from demonically inspired tormentors. Unspeakable sadness as Aslan's death occurs. For reflection and discussion, using the foregoing list as a starting point, here are avenues toward understanding the biblical aspects of Lewis's Passion story. First, if you are so inclined, you can find the specific biblical passages to which the details in chapter 14 allude. Secondly, you can notice nuances beyond the broad outline provided above that show links between the story that Lewis created and the Passion story in the Gospels. Third, this is a very moving story in which it is profitable to articulate your own feelings that are elicited at various stages of the action. And that particular chapter in the Reader's Guide ends with a rather long boxed item, but I want to share it with you as a kind of slant on what's been going on tonight. It is a literary truism that one of the functions of literature is to defamiliarize experience, to transmute what has become dulled by familiarity into something new, with the result that we take note of it and are moved by it. Here is how English poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge expressed the idea that the novelty of new works of literature confers a fresh apprehension of reality and truth. I quote, "Literature rescues the most admitted truths from the impotence caused by the very circumstance of their universal admission. Truths are too often considered as so true that they lose all the life and efficiency of truth. Literature has the power to lead us to experience such truths with a new feeling." Compare this statement by Coleridge to Lewis's own declaration of intent in terms of the Christian aspects of the Narnian stories. This is from Lewis. I thought I saw how stories of this kind could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God or about the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told what one ought to. An obligation to feel, can freeze feelings. But supposing that by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear in their real potency. Could one not thus steal past these watchful dragons? I thought one could.
Why don't you come back up, Dad, and Brian, why don't you get up? We're going to have a time for questions and answers now, and if my assistants could kind of pass through and collect any questions that people had. We did pass out some note cards for people that wanted to write a question, but you could also use one of the welcome cards in the pew rack in front of you if you wanted to ask a question. Dad, you mentioned the difference between the canonical and the chronological order of reading the Narnia stories. Reading them in the order that they were published as over against reading them in the actual kind of story of Narnia. Lewis himself said that he, in one of his letters to children, I think, commented that he thought, you know, really they ought to be read chronologically, starting with The Magician's Nephew. I recently read that Governor Jeb Bush of Florida said that we ought to read them the other way, that is to say, the canonical way. Who's right, C.S. Lewis or Jeb Bush?
This will surprise you. Jeb Bush is correct. Lewis rearticulated his desire to Walter Hooper, apparently, late in life. My co-author of the book, Marge Mead, devotes an appendix to it, and I think gives good reason to believe the stories ought to be read in the order in which Lewis envisioned them. When he wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he makes a few references to a broader story, but hadn't really imagined it yet. And her claim is we ought to, for example, meet Aslan the way we meet him in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and not have that sequence. Aslan's name is first mentioned in the Beaver's house. And it's just a marvelous scene about how everybody had certain feelings when the name of Aslan was mentioned. That's all lost if we come to it already knowing the whole history. And there are other reasons also. There's one anecdote just too good not to share. When my co-author's son was 3 years old, he pointed to a book on the bookshelf, and he wanted that one read to him, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, the three-year-old. And Marge didn't want to read it to him, knew he was too young, but found it just emotionally easier to acquiesce, start reading The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe on the assumption that he would lose interest. Well, he didn't, so she kept reading. And when they were about halfway through the story, someone was over for the evening meal, an English teacher, and three-year-old Ryan sidled up to this person without any context for his statement and said, "Do you know, Aslan is on the move."
Now, I was recently reminded of something that Lewis said about films. He said, quote unquote, that he was rather allergic to films. And as far as the, you know, I think most of us are aware that there's an upcoming movie version produced by the Walt Disney people. Should we go to the movie or not? What would C.S. Lewis do?
What Lewis would do is a speculative question, and we need not exercise our energy on that. We should go to see the movie. I saw those brief film clips, and I have to admit my appetite was whetted. And in general, I am of Lewis's opinion. I'm rather allergic to movies, but here is one that by all odds, you know, I think we ought to see.
Brian, I wonder, were the Narnia books that you read as a child at all?
I'll go here. Okay. I had the misfortune of reading Narnia after I had read Lord of the Rings. Most people do it the other way around. And my original reaction to Chronicles of Narnia was disappointment. But as I got older, I got over that.
Okay, well, that's a good setup because for the question I want to ask you, which is, going back into this material, thinking about how to read it dramatically, what really either surprised you or impressed you about the story? What came through really in a fresh way that you had forgotten? What were some of your reactions to encountering the story and preparing to do it dramatically?
There's a surprising complexity to the simpleness with which he wrote it. You can take any paragraph and isolate it and read it and go, oh, look, there's a very simplistic writing style. But he composed something that is rich within that very simpleness of his execution.
Okay. Here's a question for you, Dad. It's a question related to the Harry Potter books, which have been somewhat controversial in Christian circles, at least. Some people strongly feeling that the books are excellent books, that they stand very much in a kind of tradition of C.S. Lewis. Others very negative about those books in their use of magic and how it relates to the story. And the question is, it's a two-part question. One is, what can you tell us about the response to the Chronicles of Narnia when those books first came out? And is there anything you could tell us about, particularly in the Christian community, what the response was? And then a second part to the question, which is, do you have any counsel for parents and grandparents in distinguishing magic from miracles, or maybe just how do you think about magical elements in a book like this as a Christian with a responsibility for a child?
I don't know the details of my answer to the first one. My co-author did write a chapter on what we call in my field the reception history of the Narnia stories generally. I think they rather quickly caught on and were more popular in the U.S. than in England. As for Harry Potter, there are decisive differences between magic. Lewis and Tolkien make as much use of magic as their genre, fairy tale and romance, require and allow. And secondly, they project this very modified use of magic into an imaginary other world. Do not picture it as something going on in Philadelphia, for example. In Harry Potter, the magic occurs in this world, and there is a lot of it. And there's a lot of conjuring and doing practices that through the centuries, occultists have actually done. So there's a decisive difference in quantity of magic in the Harry Potter stories, and in drawing upon occult sources, and picturing it as occurring in this country. In this world. For Christians who read it innocently, I think the effect is the same as reading Tolkien and Lewis. I think there is an inherent, however, difference between Harry Potter and the Narnia stories. And as for the reception of them, no one, to my knowledge, uses the Narnia stories to practice occult activities.
Dad, and let me just make a comment. As we start talking, you may have some questions you want to ask that you think of later. Feel free to scribble them out and just hold your hand up, and one of my assistants will come and get it, or you could walk up and hand it to me. Would you please share what kindled your early interest in Narnia? Maybe a different way of asking that question, Dad, is when did you first start reading C.S. Lewis? And what kindled your interest in C.S. Lewis, not just in your life, but in the life of your family?
Well, my first exposure to the Narnia stories is when I was in high school and my sister came back from college, of all things, with these Narnia stories. I did not on that occasion read them. I was initiated into the Narnia stories when Mary read them to the family. So it was very much a family event. That's how Philip remembers them. One of my favorite anecdotes along these lines is Philip's comment that no childhood illness seemed complete if he did not get through all seven of the Narnia books.
What a way to be sick. And what is your, let me ask this question of both of you. Do you have a favorite C.S. Lewis book? And if so, what book is it and why? Why don't you, you want to tackle that one first, Brian, or do you want to defer?
Defer.
Okay.
Well, it is not Lewis's fiction that I primarily know. If there is a series of movies, I will get to know the Narnia books well, I hope. The current book was occasioned by the forthcoming movie, and you know, I celebrate that fact. The part of Lewis's writing that I know best is his writing of literary criticism on specific works of literature, and then his little asides and a whole book of literary theory in which he gives me good strategies for teaching literature. It was really easy to write my Reader's Guide to Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, although first my heart sank when I reread this book and thought to myself, how can I get a whole Reader's Guide out of that? Well, we ended up writing twice as much material as got printed. I just applied to Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe approximately what I apply to the works that I teach in my literature classes. I would just offer as corroboration of that, that when I come to compile the indexes for my books on literature, it's pretty obvious I quoted from C.S. Lewis's writing about literature and his literary theory more than any other source. The book that has most influenced me from Lewis is not a fictional book, but Mere Christianity.
Just two comments in following up on that question. One is that for people who have only read the fictional works of C.S. Lewis and have not read his literary criticism particularly, I mean, or some of his other writings on Christianity. I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of books that C.S. Lewis wrote. And if you've enjoyed some of them, you're likely to enjoy some of the others as well. Do you want to take a stab at that question at all, Brian?
The first
one? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to let you okay. Much shorter, the problem of pain, because like most of us, I needed wisdom on the problem of pain, so that's it.
Do you want to say anything about anything that was helpful in Lewis's writing on that subject at all for you? Or?
It's a lot of people.
Yeah. Maybe this isn't the time or the place. I had one other thought about the... I can't remember what it was. Let me ask you, this is a general question, Dad, and then there'll be some specific parts of it. We've got some theologians here, people interested in theology, and concerned about some aspects of Lewis's theology, at least as it appears to be in some of his writings. He's sometimes come under attack from conservative evangelical Christians and possibly in some areas of his theology from Reformed Christians. How should we think about that? I mean, just to give one example, at the end of the last battle, there's a scene in which one of the worshipers of Tosh, that is the god of the Kalormans, is received into fellowship with Aslan in his kingdom, as if to say that you could come to know Aslan through another religion. And that's been deeply troubling to Christians who believe in the uniqueness of salvation in Christ and would not want that to be confused with worshiping God in another religion. Do you want to just comment on that generally? How should we think about that as Christians? What influence does that have on how we read these books and so forth?
Well, I have several thoughts. One is, it's a rare book in which we agree with everything the author has said. That's a very rare book. So we're under no obligation to agree with Lewis on everything. But if we don't agree with them on certain points, that's no reason not to value most of what he has written, even within that work. On the other side, no writer is above criticism and disagreement. So we need to exercise our prerogative as readers of disagreeing with an author, and maybe that's a point at which we would do that. We do have to remember also that works of literature take certain freedoms, or maybe we should put it this way, to embody something in a story. It's not the same as writing and thinking theologically, not necessarily the same. So we have to allow a certain latitude there. It's a way of saying that before we reach any very hard and fast conclusion regarding that detail in the conclusion to the last battle, I think we have to search for corroboration of that elsewhere in Lewis's writing, and it might be there. And then if so, then that's a point at which we would feel quite free to disagree with Lewis. Lewis's views of scriptural authority, as articulated in his book Reflections on the Psalms, is not an evangelical position. So we have a right to disagree with Lewis on that.
Yes, for example, I mean, he does say in his Reflections on the Psalms that the Bible has error in it. That's not in keeping with an evangelical view of the inerrancy of Scripture, for example. Brian, this is a question for you. I think you'll be willing to answer this one. Did it actually say what it said about poisons and other things, if I told you, your parents wouldn't let you read the book?
Yes.
Yeah, that's really in there, right?
Correct.
It's kind of the, what's that called, Dad, when an author kind of makes an aside where he's addressing the reader directly like that? Is there a literary term for that? Is there a device that goes with that?
No, it's just a strategy. I don't know the name for it. There's a latent humor in Lewis, and that's the point of humor.
Question about the film that's coming out. One person is asking, how can Christians use the movie to evangelize? That is to say, use the movie to introduce people to aspects of the Christian faith. But there's somebody else asking here if we should even do that. Should we do it? The movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as an evangelism tool, outreach of the church, do you think it will be effective? Do you have some thoughts on that theme?
You know, I don't like the phraseology, tool of evangelism. That would be an instance of what Lewis called using. My approach is approximately what I proposed by way of reading. I would engage people who have attended the movie, first of all, at the same level at which I would discuss any other movie with them. You know, what did they like? What did they think the meaning was, etc.? I would say a discussion growing out of that would lead, potentially, to issues of faith. I wouldn't go in thinking of it as an evangelistic tool. I would use it as the occasion to engage in dialogue.
This is a question related somewhat, I think, to the Harry Potter question. And in a way, you touched on it, but maybe you just want to give a short answer to this. Is it moral to read a book that has magic in it apart from a divine power? Is it moral to read a book that has magic in it apart from a divine power? What cautions would you give?
The caution, I don't consider it immoral, as long as we are not being led into, for example, occult activity. You have to understand that a lot that's put into fairy tales and myths is there to serve a kind of literary purpose. In itself, it may not at all be intended to be a direct route to what we do in real life. Stories like, let's put it into the broader category, fantasy. Fantasy gives us metaphors of the human condition, metaphors, pictures of. We know that in real life, animal characters don't talk, but that's a convention of the fairy tale. And when we put together the details in a fantasy story, we don't mistake them for real life, as Samuel Johnson said, but they bring real life to mind, so that there's a kind of analogy at work, potentially, and we ought to let that. It is possible that the magic in a fairy story is quite innocuous. It's possible. And as long as it is not leading to thinking about the occult in our world in a way that we think is untrue, I don't think there is a harm in reading that kind of story. I'm no devotee of the Harry Potter books. I've not read them. Everything I hear about them by way of the occult dimension leads me not to want to read them. Having said that, if you're a Christian reader and assimilating all this and the way in which you assimilate Tolkien and Lewis, then I see nothing wrong with that.
This is a question on this is really a broad question. You can answer any aspect of it that you want. What was the relationship between C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien? It's interesting that, they had a personal friendship, taught together at the University of Oxford. And in many ways, I think it's true that the Lord of the Rings films have opened the door for the Narnia films, which have been talked about for more than a decade, now really to come to the fore and people know that they have a chance to be successful. But let me add this to that, if you want to comment on their relationship at all. And then here's a specific question. Do you know if Tolkien, like Lewis, created the narrative from the beginning to the end, or if he wrote the end or knew the end before writing the narrative?
If I'm right, the answer to the latter question is no. They didn't have the whole story in mind. It doesn't mean they didn't plan things out. The relationship between Lewis and Tolkien was very much symbiotic. They met weekly. They read their fiction to each other. If I'm right, Tolkien didn't like the Narnia stories. Does that ring a bell? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, he thought they were kind of insubstantial, not serious. And by comparison with the Lord of the Rings, you can see why he might have thought that.
Apparently, the literary friendship that meant most in the composition of the Narnia stories was that of Roger Lancelot Green. Tolkien, not much help by way of encouragement on the Narnia stories.
No, but people have enjoyed them nonetheless, no matter what Tolkien thought. In considering similarities, let me just say, we'll go about 5 more minutes with this question and answer time. If you had any question you were dying to ask, find a way to get it up here. Considering similarities between the Narnia tales and the biblical story, are the stories better the first time or better with time? And that's particularly given this narrative pattern of creation, fall, redemption, consummation. Does knowing the last battle help to better understand this sort of passion part of the story?
Well, that's an interesting question. I thought the question initially was asking, is the first reading of a story and of these stories a better literary experience? No, it is different from every ensuing experience. But every rereading is a genuinely new reading. Lewis has some of the best comments about rereading that I have read, and he's all in favor of it. And he thinks stories are just not very good if you don't have the pleasures of rereading them. I think we do not. For me personally, I don't think that my experience of chapter 14 is deepened or helped by my acquaintance with the last battle. I think every book, every book was composed as a self-contained entity, and ought to be experienced as such. Can be experienced as such.
This is a question in some ways you've answered, but maybe you could just give us a simple, clear answer to this question. Did C.S. Lewis write the story as a story or as a Christian book?
He wrote it as a story.
And why, then, does it come across in so many ways as a Christian book? What's the simplest answer to that?
The simplest answer is, in Lewis's word, that aspect forced itself into the story.
He couldn't help it. He wasn't trying to write a Christian book, but he couldn't help but do that.
You know, I think I would hesitate. I think I'm going to theorize Lewis would not demur from saying he wrote a Christian book and was probably trying to. But that does not then mean that he set about seeing how many Christian doctrines he could embody in it. You know, his own statements, as I quoted them, are a pretty good guide to how he did it and what he intended.
Do you have any suggestions about how parents particularly, or perhaps teachers, can engage a child's imagination? I mean, you talked at a couple of points just about the importance of imagination, entering into the imaginative world of a literary work. Do you have any other comments about how to, why is it important to stimulate the imagination of a child? How do you do that?
Well, you do it by reading to the child and then encouraging the child's reading good literature after the child is able to read it. That's the best training for the imagination. Parental example, I think, is what packs the biggest punch. And that begins by reading to little children. My co-author was more adamant than I would be, but I'm going to take her word for it, because she's an expert in children's literature, that the religious meanings of the Narnia stories should be allowed to unfold themselves to a child or to a reader at whatever level that child or reader is able to assimilate the religious meanings at that stage of development. And Philip himself, in an address that then became published, recalls how impatient he was when his mother would try to make sure he was catching the allegorical or the religious meanings of it.
This has become kind of a sore point in the family, because people come up to my mom now and say, why are your husband and your son saying these terrible things about you in print?
What's the formula that they use, Mary, about hitting on the mother again or something?
Yeah. Very quickly, Dad, do you want to say anything about Lewis's autobiography, Surprised by Joy?
I haven't reread it recently enough to say anything. It's the best source on Lewis's own account of the growth of his imagination.
What about Till We Have Faces, which is a more mature, really a novel more for adults than for children? Do you have? Are you kind of up on Till We Have Faces
not
at all?
Not in the least.
Do you want to comment on the differences between it and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe at all?
Oh, the space trilogy, I think, requires a much more advanced and sophisticated literary taste. More difficult books. Not children's books.
This is probably a follow-up to something you just said. How do you define good literature? You said, encourage your children to read good literature. How would you define good literature or literature worth reading?
Well, these terms need to be defined, I realize. Artistically excellent, with a certain depth of significant contact with human experience remains a touchstone for literature. Do we feel when we have finished this story we have been put in touch with reality, with human experience? That to me is a touchstone. I enjoy literature in which the interpretive light falls from the right direction rather than the wrong direction, though I don't avoid reading literature in which finally I disagree with the theme. Artistry of expression, significance of contact with reality and human experience, profundity of thought. That would be the catch-all. Whether I agree or not with the themes, the themes have been embodied, so that it's you know, the criterion of escapism is not totally incorrect. It's just that all reading is an escape. But there is such a thing as reading something that merely removes us from waking reality, and we carry nothing back by way of renewed understanding of life, ability to be God's person in life. And if we can't make, if there's no carryaway value, then that literature is not as good as literature with which there is the carryaway value.
Let me remind you that in the reception hall at the back of the sanctuary, there are copies of this book, A Reader's Guide Through the Wardrobe. I'm sure my father would be happy to sign copies if anyone was interested. There is a table set up of materials by and about C.S. Lewis and some of his other colleagues from the 10th.